Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby. AlphaList is a closed community with over 400 CTOs who share their knowledge and experience in a Slack space and at events. With this podcast, we want to give our members and interested parties insights into the thoughts and ideas of top CTOs. If you're interested in becoming a member of the community, please visit alphalist.com to find out more on how to apply. This episode is kindly supported by Fastly, the biggest challenger in the CDN market. Fastly is pushing ahead the technical boundaries and is, from my perspective, the best solution on the market. Fastly is known as one of the key drivers of the edge cloud movement. Well-known customers of Fastly are Shopify, the New York Times, Reddit, GitHub, and many, many more. If you want to try it all with first-class support, just go to fastly.com/alphalist. So, welcome to the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby, and my guest today is an absolute internet and publishing veteran. He published, I think, thousands of books in the last 40 years, and I think he pretty much made my nerdy life much more enjoyable. He predicted tech trends such as the Web 2.0 and is referred to as the Oracle of the Valley. He is a fearless geek and philosopher. He is father, author, VC, and probably a really great guy. It's Tim O'Reilly. So thanks, Tim, for being here with me. And I don't know if I forgot any detail about yourself.
No, I think that's just fine. I have chickens in my backyard. How's that?
That's nice. So first of all, I want to thank you because you made so many hours so much more enjoyable and saved me a lot of time in the past. So thank you for that. And maybe you can tell us a bit more of how you save time of your readers.
Well, that kind of goes back in a lot of ways to the very beginning of my technical writing career, where, and it's very hard for people to understand today just how bad it was in the early 1980s. And we're writing manuals and, you know, you want to basically write about, hey, this feature doesn't work, or here's how you work around it. And we were consulting writers and they're like, oh, you can't say bad things about our product, and in fact, they didn't even want you to write in the, address the reader. You know, it was all written in the third person, the product does this. And it was so liberating when we published our own books that we could literally say, this feature doesn't work. I remember working, once we started publishing and not just writing our own books, I remember working with an author and he said, I can't write chapter 7 because the software doesn't work yet. And I said, yeah, you can write it. That's what you write. because otherwise everybody's going to think it's them. You know, that's an incredible gift to be able to tell them that this particular, stuff doesn't really work. And, that ability to capture the knowledge of users was where we really started. I remember a very early book that one of our first bestsellers, although certainly, it went on to sell hundreds of thousands of copies, but pre-internet, everybody was using UUCP dial-up for networking, and Usenet was social media long before there was social media. And we had written the manager's guide for how you did this stuff, and it was very arcane. It's a dial-up network, and I didn't have access to all the equipment. You had to basically negotiate. Write it what was called a chat script to get through various prompts. It was a little bit of in some way scripting the modem or scripting the networking device, and people would just send in tips. Here's the chat script for the, I can't remember the name anymore, and I don't have a copy of that edition of the book, but let's just say it's the AT&T 5510 port contender, and it would be like, I'd go, great. I just drop it in the book. And the book grew from about 80 pages in the first edition to about 200 over the next, you know, 10 editions. And we would basically update it every time we reprinted it, mostly with just feedback from users. So it was really a user contributed aspect of our publishing, where we just learned from our users and then reflected it back out. Now, of course, today with the internet, you get that kind of stuff all the time. But we had this idea of that we wanted to anticipate what the reader needed to know. And one of the things I was proudest of in one of our X Window System books, again, it was probably late 80s, one of our readers wrote in, he said, every time the question is just starting to surface in my mind, the answer is on the next page. And I thought that putting things in the right order was also a huge part of what we always tried to do in our books. And it's what we try to do today in our online platform. You know, I guess that's the thing that we didn't talk about. The bulk of O'Reilly's business today is not publishing. It's our online learning platform, which is, yes, it's part of our publishing business, and a significant part of our publishing revenue comes from our own platform. But it's also a platform for hundreds of other technology publishers, video trainers, live online training, interactive. You know, we bought Katacoda, which lets you do live coding. We've kind of got an Answers product, which is a machine learning powered search that lets you ask plain language questions and get answers from any of the thousands of books, and it's amazingly transformative, you know, and so much better than the search we had before. It's also we're about to roll out you know, answer search from video, and it's just it's astonishing just to go to just the right magic moment, you know, go, oh, actually, yeah, somebody talked about that in the video from our you know, 2016 open source convention talk on, you know, Kubernetes or whatever, you know. It's anyway, having access to all of that is pretty transformative.
Yeah, so distribution changed a lot, I guess. And you yeah. actually invented Stack Overflow way before Joe Spolsky did, right? So
well, not really. I mean, I think that, you know, Joel did a fantastic job of understanding that you could really do a real you know, Q&A platform on the internet. But I do think that there's a real place for what we do, which is, you know, curated content. You know, one of the problems with Stack Overflow is you're not actually sure that it's the right answer. You know, you have to kind of wade through as you can with much on the internet, and you have a four or five different voices. And again, I suppose that's true a little bit when you have different books, but we like to feel like we've done a better job of identifying good answers and putting you know, good people in front of the people who need to hear from them. Mm-hmm.
So in a way, it's also the difference between intent and inspiration, right? I think If I look at, for example, one book I had in the, I think, late zeros was your Ruby cookbook, where mm-hmm. I got a lot of inspiration from how things can actually be done and which things can actually be done, which I would never look for in Stack Overflow, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, I think that's right. And I do think that there's something wonderful in books in that we still haven't entirely mastered online, which is they can give you the big picture and then you can dive in, you can kind of leaf through them. You know, I think of how many programmers I know used to go in the days when you could only see them in bookstores. You'd go in and you know, that would be your recreation. You'd go in and, you know, see what are the new books that are out. And there's something to be said for limits. I remember Alexander Pope, the poet, used to write in rhyme couplets in the late 1800s. Early late 1700s. And he said he liked writing in this very limited form because it made his creativity come out through like the narrow aperture of a fountain. And the internet obviously has a lot of amazing stuff, but it also has a lot of dreck. And when you impose limits on what you have to say, you can actually hone what you do. And there are people, I think, some of our books, particularly in the last couple of years, I think are really masterpieces of exposition. Antonopoulos's books on Bitcoin or blockchain, Aurelien Geron's book on machine learning. They're brilliant. They do a brilliant job of laying out the ideas and teaching from the ground up, but also you can jump in and get to really powerful levels of detail. Mm. And of course, and with the internet, on our platform, for example, you can actually go try the stuff. We have either Katacoda or Jupyter Notebooks associated with many of the books. And so you actually can work with the code. Mm. And we're continuing to go further along with that. Mm.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So I remember also the book Collective Intelligence. It pretty much inspired me in so many ways to really understand what is possible in machine learning and where to look at. So it's way easier to start with a book.
That's right. That was one of the early ones, Toby Sagarin. Yeah, that was a great book. Can I give you a little point? Just about, there's this famous saying in VC, which is also true in publishing, which is being too early is the equivalent of being wrong. I mean, that book wasn't a great bestseller because it was just really on the front end of the wave. But if you want to go back even, I forget when we published that, but it was well before the machine learning hype. But we actually hired John Orwant, who used to be one of the, Big Pearl guys as our CTO in 2000, I think it was. And he wanted to start publishing on machine learning then. He was like, this is the next big thing. Yeah. And of course it was, but if we had published books on machine learning in 2000, they wouldn't have gone anywhere at all.
Yeah, it's a bit of a too early prediction, right? Comparable to mobile back then in the early 90s. So
ebooks, the Kindle came out in 2007. Our first ebook product was in 1994, I think.
a little early. One thing you just mentioned in a way is a trend I also see that writing somehow is also technical writing, but also writing prose somehow develops as being a secret superpower also in some corporations. So Amazon, for example, I think in product, they often start with a press release, right? And they start writing a press release for a feature that you as a product guy just have to write to better understand yourself and better structure yourself. I think that's a nice thing, right?
Yeah, well, I think it's not just that you learn to write better. And Amazon's idea of memos is also that people read them and they're therefore prepared for the meeting. When you think about how much time is wasted in a meeting of somebody going through a PowerPoint, so it's all one way. Whereas if it's a little bit like the flipped classroom, in some sense, where you watch the lecture beforehand and then you have a discussion. You could do it with, somebody could record a presentation, maybe would have the same impact. But there's something about reading a well-structured piece of writing that allows you to, think about it, to digest it, to interact. And then, you've all just read it and then they sit there and they discuss it. And I think it's a much more productive meeting.
Maybe we step a little further back in your early days. So, I think you started your company in the 70s, right?
Well, very first beginning would have been 78. So it was a mini computer era. And by the way, correcting dates, that first ebook was not 94, it was 87.
Wow.
So 20 years before the Kindle. I definitely started in the mini computer era. The big companies were Digital Equipment Corporation, HP, Prime Computer, Data General. They're all companies that are long gone, with the exception of HP. And I think the very first manual I ever wrote was an assembly language manual.
What is the history behind that? I mean, what is your nerd path? How did you get into computing at all? How did you discover that as like being something that is your field of interest?
You know, it was actually through writing. I had a friend who was a programmer, and he got asked to write a manual, and he had no idea how to do it, but he was desperate for work. He was a contract programmer, and I said I'd help him out. And so the first job we did together, he just would come back and, we'd work. I kind of rewrote the stuff that he brought back. And a lot of technical writing in those days was simply rewriting specifications and other documents. So I didn't really know what I was talking about. And in fact, then we got our first job together where we kind of pitched this idea. If you put a programmer and a writer together, you'd get better work than you'd get, if you had, one, because, he could ask the deep technical questions and I could help produce better prose. And for whatever reason, they bought it. And but it was really quite amusing because the first couple of years, I didn't know anything. I still remember the very first meeting I went to with my friend, the programmer. And afterwards we came out and I said, was he pulling my leg? Because basically, they were just talking gibberish. The terminology just didn't make any sense. And, it was just through a lot of reading and that I started to make a picture of how everything worked. And it was learning by doing. And in some ways, I did some of my best work, and it was very formative for how I developed my editorial approach, which was, it was really pattern recognition and seeing how all the pieces connected without necessarily knowing what they were. And I remember once, for example, there was a manual that we were working on, and we had specs from three different engineers, and they just talked about everything differently. And I suddenly had this, we were kind of putting out the manual where it was this chapter from this guy and a chapter. And I went, wait. No, they're all talking about the same damn thing, from different angles. And we have to rewrite this completely. And, you can often really simplify things when you're just, you're just looking at, I actually used the analogy, before, you can see, if you go to a soccer game or a football game or a basketball game, if you have your back farther, you can actually see the patterns more. And so I've often felt like a lot of my observations about the big picture of what's going on in Silicon Valley are because I was living in Sebastopol, which is an hour north of San Francisco, at a time when most of the action was down in, Cupertino and Palo Alto, so 2 hours away. I was watching from a distance. I wasn't going to all the parties. I wasn't talking to the people. I was just making my own observations about what was going on, where so many people were so enmeshed in the inner narrative that they were too close to see the patterns. And so I just had learned a lot about pattern recognition over the years. And that's where a lot of the work that I did, in terms of activism became so important. For example, on open source software, it was like where I said, wait a minute, there's this narrative about free software, but it only includes software that has the GPL. Why wouldn't it also, that narrative, why doesn't it include the World Wide Web? It was put in the public domain. You can't get freer than that. Why wouldn't it include Apache? That has a different license, the X Windows system. And I had kind of cut my own teeth in Berkeley Unix rather than in Linux. And so BSD was sort of my, You know, in particular, I had this sense of the early Unix community around Berkeley, and you know, Berkeley was contributing to AT&T System 5 and System 3. My first Unix was actually, I think it was actually Unix version 7 out of Bell Labs, but and then pretty quickly System 3 and System 5, and BSD. I think it was probably 4.1 was my first BSD, and you know, I just watched that community build the software collaboratively, even though AT&T had this restrictive license. I went, oh, the license is maybe has a good political purpose, but it's not the cause of what's going on. And we need to understand this phenomenon, you know, including all of the pieces, you know, and you go, if we don't have a story that includes, you know, the web and the internet, you know, and the fact that Bill Joy wrote the TCP/IP stack that's used everywhere, including in Microsoft Windows, we don't actually, you know, the fact that Paul Vixie wrote, you know, Bind, you know, if we don't include that in the narrative, we could, it's like a map with only half the roads. And so we need a new map. And so that idea of drawing maps of technology and thinking about them, you know, something that's been with me throughout my career. Kind of, what are you seeing that's missing from the dominant narrative?
Is that also why you started with conferences? I think you back then started the OSCON conference to actually help people finding through that jungle of different directions.
No. Actually, I would say the first conference we did was actually our Perl conference, which grew into OSCON. But it wasn't really driven by the goal of unpacking the knowledge when we first did that. It was really the fact that there was no marketing department for free software. You know, and it was literally sparked by the fact that Sun had just launched Java 1. And I went, well, who's going to do that for Perl? I mean, Programming Perl was the best-selling computer book of the day. Perl was referred to as the duct tape of the internet. And everybody's talking about Java. And in fact, there was this great story, Andrew Shulman, who was a writer who actually wrote about Windows. But he had this story about Microsoft's ActiveX, which was this technology that they had released. And they had a big television ad campaign. And Andrew has written books like Undocumented DOS and, you know, Unauthorized Windows. He did some analysis on the technology that was shown in the ads. And he said, you know, the only part of that demo that they showed in their television ad was a little animated taxi cab. That was the only part that was ActiveX. Everything else was done with Perl. and I thought, oh my God, you know, how do we tell the story about this important technology? And more than that, how do we bring these people together? Because that was the other thing. You know, Perl existed, and you know, this is still pretty early in the web. I mean, there were websites to be sure. I mean, it was, 97 when we launched that. But it was mostly mailing lists. And you knew all these people from their text voice. And I still remember, like, I imagine Larry Wall is so different in person than he was as a writer, you know, and you read Larry, a big personality, you know. I imagine him as this sort of red bearded pirate, you know, and then you meet Larry and he's this very quiet, thoughtful guy, you know, who's very loud and incisive and funny. And, when he writes, and all these people just knew each other from mailing lists, and the joy of that first conference, again, it was just, I wanted to throw a party for Perl. I wanted to say, you guys matter. And I remember I my head of marketing went and found a hotel. And I said, no, this isn't good enough for Perl. We have to have a better hotel. You know, let's take the risk. And we really sought a subsidized marketing for the community, you know, to tell the story that this language matters. And then, of course, you know, we followed that up with the what came to be called the Open Source Summit. And then we realized, oh, we need to, you know, do this for all of the communities, because here's this movement that's incredibly important. And it's just starting to be recognized. I mean, nobody knew. You know, when I first put all these guys up on stage together and had a press conference, and I said, you know, well, all these guys have in common. And I said, I called out to the audience, you know, do you guys have a website? Yeah, NewYorkTimes.com. Okay, well, do you know why? And I don't remember at the time I was prepared with, I remembered what the New York Times IP address is. Do you know why you don't? It's because this long-haired guy here wrote the software. Hey, you send email. It's this long-haired guy here, you know? you know, and it was actually, and I wrote this, you know, this narrative, that open source was actually the heart and soul of the internet of the day, you know? And it was really amazing period, because over the next week, it was about a week, I probably did 40 interviews in the week after that. And at first it was like, this is this crazy idea. You mean open source isn't this radical movement that's sort of trying to overpower, commercial software? No, this is the inside of all this big, the big hottest commercial thing that's going on today. And to have everybody wake up to that. And that's why I've always loved that. There's this phrase from Edmund Schlossberg, who once said that the skill of writing is to create a context in which other people can think. You know, and I told a story that changed the way people thought about why this software mattered. And it was really just telling, you know, a better story, that it wasn't just about Linux, it was about the internet. And Linux was part of the story, but it wasn't all of the story.
Hmm. And how do you think this story now changed? I mean, I think open source became a much less independent playground of the big corporates.
Yeah.
What do you think of today's world of open source and today's world of also the web and how it changed and evolved?
Yeah, well, it's kind of funny, of course, because I got in a lot of trouble with the open source community by saying pretty early on that, and particularly with the free software community, that their licenses weren't going to work. You know, because of the way that software was changing. I had an exchange with Richard Stallman at a conference in Germany. It was called Masters of OS, or Wizards of OS, I think it was called, in Berlin in 99. And RMS came out in the Q&A, and he was sort of questioning me. But I was just basically saying, look, if you had all of Amazon's source code, you could not run Amazon. You know, if you had all of Google's source code, you couldn't. I mean, Google was much less visible at that time. So I think I'm mainly talking about Amazon. It's got all these business processes. It's got, it's really an application that people are running. And Richard's response was, well, it's not running on my computer, so it doesn't matter. And I was like, no, you're wrong. It really, you know, software is no longer, you know, in a lot of ways, the first wave of open source was that it was an artifact of how software was being distributed in the early internet era. And I don't think people understood that enough, that there was an architecture of participation that was fundamental. Where, you know, if you looked at the freeware culture of the PC, you didn't have source code. And the reason was that you could just distribute compile binaries and they ran. But Unix had this crazy architecture where you had a standard operating system that ran on different kinds of hardware. So you actually had to modify the software in order to run it. You know, it was mostly portable, but it still had to be ported. And so you had to distribute source code. And people never realized enough how formative that was to the original open source movement. And what I saw was that architecture was going away. You know, that effectively when you started to move to what we now call software as a service, and you know, you basically could just provide portability without providing source code. So you still had other reasons why source code really matters. It's a great way to learn. It's a great way to, if you need to modify the code, but it was going to have a very different place. And of course, you know, if you, you know, companies now use it strategically, but, you know, like Google will open source, you know, TensorFlow because it, they see that as a way to get their way of doing machine learning to be more widely adopted. It's a way of training talent without having to pay to train them. But, you know, it's not essential in the way that it was in the 90s. Just isn't. You know, that was the, you know, like I wrote a piece. It was, I guess I'm trying to remember when it was. It was sometime in the 90s. I wrote a piece for Nature, the science magazine. And it was really about, it was a meditation on Stuart Brand's statement, information wants to be free. And everybody would always forget that he added, but it also wants to be valuable. And I kind of wrote about the way that Bill Gates and Larry Wall both had the same goal. They wanted to make their information valuable. They wanted to make software valuable. And Larry basically said, oh, well, I'm not an entrepreneur. I know how to make my software valuable. I want to get it into more hands and I want to give back to the people who gave me so much. And of course, Larry, people have forgotten this now, but you know, one of Larry's you know, greatest contributions to the open source movement was Patch. You know, the software that, you know, basically allowed people to, again, you were in a very low bandwidth environment. And so people literally sent around diff files rather than entire bodies of source code. And Patch was the program that read the diff file and figured out how to apply the changes to basically make an updated version out of the old version. And, you know, that was huge for that open source community because, you know, if, you know, when Berkeley Unix was being distributed as open source, nobody was downloading it. You were sending tapes, you know, 9-track tapes. And so, you know, it's very easy to think in today's internet when you can move massive amounts of data. But no, you didn't do that. I still actually have framed on the wall the diskettes that I got. I was running an old, you know, kind of a now long gone Unix machine. We had written the manuals for Burroughs of all companies. They had bought a company called Convergent Technologies, and we had written the manual for the B20, Burroughs B20, and it was our first Unix system that we actually, you know, got to have our own, as opposed to working on a client site. And it didn't have, you know, Usenet. Sorry, it didn't have, what was it? No, it didn't have TCP/IP on it. And we were on Usenet, and I put out a request. I said, does anybody have TCP/IP for the Convergent Technologies MiniFrame or Burroughs B20? And some guy from John Langeling was his name. I still remember it. And I have the little mailer and the diskette, you know, framed on my wall. Some random guy at, I think it was at Denison University in Ohio, or, you know, just mailed me this, you know, these diskettes with TCP/IP. And that's how we got ourselves actually onto the internet.
Thanks a lot to our sponsor, the About You Cloud. The About You Cloud offers a full-stack e-commerce solution as a service that runs on exactly the same infrastructure as the About You Shop does. It is mobile-first, can act as headless system, event-driven, can be fully localized, and is super integrated into existing solutions. Besides that, it is designed and developed by a really smart CTO and friend of mine, Sebastian Betz. About You has set up a task force for retailers and brands that want to be quick in the COVID situation. This task force will help you with the launch of your shop, as well as with fulfillment, marketing, support, and internationalization. Simply write to hello@aboutyou.com to be supported by this task force.
Yeah, it's a nice and very geeky time it was back then, right? And
oh, it was
hard to really compare it to today's platform economy, where companies that never wanted to be evil in a way changed, and I don't know, Facebook is playing God and locks you out whenever they want to. So in a way, that must be sad to see, isn't it?
No, not really. I guess I would say, first of all, I predicted it. You know, I see a lot of these technologies run in cycles. And in a lot of ways, a lot of my thinking, say, about Web 2.0 was driven by, the company that was dominant when I first entered the industry, which was IBM. IBM was, and then, you know, how Microsoft had overthrown them because there'd been a change. You know, I wrote a paper, I think it was in, it was sort of a talk, I think in 97, called Hardware, Software, and Infoware. That's what I called it. And it was this idea that IBM had dominated the industry through control over hardware. You know, they basically owned the standard, and they didn't realize that they didn't see that the PC was going to be a big market. So they opened it up because they were kind of coming from behind in the microcomputer market. They published the specs, and then other people could make them. And Bill Gates recognized that the in a world where there were multiple providers of the hardware, the software would be the lock-in point. And so that transition of power from IBM to Microsoft was the hardware to software transition. And I started asking myself, well, what's happening with the web? You know, so I started thinking about, so actually that would have been when was that paper? Yeah, I guess that was 97. I wrote this paper. I remember delivering it again in Germany. Again, it was at Linux Congress in Würzburg, and it was the same place where Eric Raymond first delivered the Cathedral and the Bazaar. And I gave this talk, and I was like, okay, well, the web is yet another platform change, and it's going to lead to a shift in power away from Microsoft. You know, open source and the open standards of the internet are going to change the game. And that's when I first began to speculate about what was going to become valuable was going to be data. And, you know, so I saw this thing where companies who were the upstarts, the radicals, somebody wins, they become powerful, they try to hold on to power, you know. And so that was, again, when that really developed out eventually into my, you know, sort of ideas about Web 2.0, which was the second coming of the web after the dot-com bust. Big data was going to be the center, cloud computing, although we didn't use that term. But also this idea that one of my principles was data is the Intel inside, of course, because Intel was the other monopolist. And so the idea was that data would be the next source of monopoly. And so I remember back in that point, I said, Web 2.0 opens with collective intelligence and harnessing collective intelligence, but it ends with data is the Intel inside. And of course, we see that now with the monopoly dominance of companies like Google and Facebook, and now they're all being investigated just like Microsoft was, and they've suppressed competition and they extract economic rents. That's actually that's probably something we didn't talk about. I have a project working with Mariana Mazzucato and her crew at Institute for Innovation and Public Purpose at University College London. And we're really doing research on how Amazon, Google, and really all of the big platform companies today extract what I've started to call algorithmic rents. That is, they use their algorithms and designs to figure out who gets the value out of the system. And increasingly, they assign that value to themselves. You see it very obviously in Google, where you used to have organic search results. And, you know, now it's dominated by ads, which is putting money into Google's pocket.
Which is exactly the opposite they wanted to do initially, right?
Yeah. And it really goes to show that you can talk yourself into anything. There's this great quote from Upton Sinclair, who was a... when he was, you know, the novelist, muckraking novelist who wrote The Jungle about meatpacking, but he was also a socialist firebrand, and he ran for president in the 30s during the Great Depression. And he had this great line when he was in campaign. He said, "It is difficult to get a man to believe a thing when his salary depends on him not believing it." Mm. And you think about that with all the tech titans who have to believe they're still serving the user. You know, I mean, they have to be able to say, no, this is still in the interest of the user. Because if they couldn't face themselves if they didn't believe that. And it becomes more and more obvious to people on the outside that it's user hostile behavior. You know, I'm kind of trying to make that campaign with Amazon right now. I just wrote a piece, you know, critiquing Jeff's last shareholder letter. And I said, look, you want to be, you know, he ends with like, don't be ordinary. I go, yeah, if you don't want to be ordinary, you have to actually recognize your ad business cannot be serving the user ultimately. You know, it's like you used to show us the best product. Now you show us ads, you know, people who pay you. That's a step backwards if you really want to say you're going to be relentlessly focused on the user.
Yeah, I think that besides showing ads, copying various successful products from small vendors is also a bad thing to do, right? It's also leading to less choice and no freedom of choice anymore, right?
Well, it is interesting because, of course, again, this goes back to this question of how it's very easy to convince yourself you're doing the right thing. You can still say to yourself, well, you know, those people, you know, we're lowering prices for consumers, so that's a good thing. You know, or we're improving the quality, or you know, and we do have a narrative where that's considered okay. You know, except in limited cases. And I think in general, you know, that's sort of my critique of our current version of capitalism is it excuses a lot of sins on the basis that, well, you know, a more dynamic competitive economy is good for everyone. So therefore, let everybody, you know, go be evil and it'll come out in the wash. And it, you know, we all now know that that's not true. And a lot of what I have been writing about lately is a kind of a machine learning informed idea about the economy. And that is, you know, if you think about how optimization functions work in machine learning, we really are trying to optimize. And metaphorically, even if you have many sub-optimization functions, you know, the companies like Google and Facebook are really trying to optimize originally for, you know, Google, for example, in search was always trying to optimize for you find what you want and you go away. That was their ultimate goal. Facebook was, we want you to spend more time on the site and interact with more content. Engagement was their key optimization. And, you know, I realized, oh, well, we do that in our economy, too. And so, for example, in my book, WTF, I talk about how after World War II, they learned the lesson of what happened after World War I, which is, you beggar the people who were defeated. You don't take care of your returning soldiers. You end up with you keep pandering to wealth. You end up with a great worldwide depression and another war. We're not doing that again. So then they decide we're going to optimize for full employment. They have the GI Bill. When they have people come back, they have the Marshall Plan to rebuild Europe and Japan. And we have basically 20 years of prosperity. And then there's this thing the economists call Goodhart's Law, which is once you start optimizing for something, it ceases to be a good measure because it starts getting gamed. It starts not working for various reasons. And then you end up in the super high inflation of the 70s. And they go, oh, we need a new optimization function. And they say, oh, we know what it is. It's shareholder value. You know, it's basically the only, you know, Milton Friedman, the only obligation of the social obligation of a business is to increase its profits. And again, that does make the economy more efficient. It seems to work for, you know, 20 years. And then it goes really off the rails. So now we're ready for another reset.
So every once in a while you put duct tape on it, right?
Well, no. You have to actually really rethink it. And I think we're right in the middle of a deep economic rethinking of, are we optimizing for the right thing? And the thing I'm trying to do is to use this moment in tech, you know, where we can see, you know, say Facebook as a mirror. And we can say, oh, wait a minute. Facebook is thought that it would bring people together if they showed them more of the content that they liked and responded to. And in fact, it drove them apart. They were wrong about their optimization function. So can we also see that we thought that this optimization function that we set for our economy would make us all more prosperous. But we now understanding that it drove inequality and that it's not really working anymore, we've got to fix it. You know, like if we can ask Facebook to fix it, can we also see that we got to fix our general economy? And there's a great term from Charlie Strauss, the science fiction writer. He says he calls corporations slow AIs. And of course, governments are also slow AIs. They are, in fact, independent of their creators. And that's also a key idea in my thinking, which is in some ways in this era of collective intelligence, when we talk about artificial intelligence, we're missing the point, which is that what's really happening is we're building these hybrids of human and machine. You know, that Google or Facebook, when we do, say image recognition, you know, it's like humans are part of that. Google search, you know, humans designed it, humans are tuning it, but you know, so the algorithms were trained by humans, but there's this constant feedback loop. Oh, people clicked on the second link instead of the first link. They must like the second one better. The whole idea of the long click versus the short click that Google uses. These are, you know, we are part of the machine. And when we, I think when we look back on this, we'll go, why did they ever think that, you know, the AIs would be independent of us? I think we're part of this new global machine. I gave a bunch of talks back. I don't know, must be, God, is it 10 years ago, towards a global brain, you know, where we really are building a global brain, and it is us. And it is us mediated and connected by our machines into ever more complex patterns. And again, that's not to say that we won't have things that appear to be independent AIs, but they really are. I think even then, I think if something like Alexa becomes smarter and smarter, it will be because it is more and more enmeshed with all of its users.
Obviously, but still, it can lead to technology taking over tasks that beforehand nobody or we needed human to fulfill, and then you lose jobs and so on?
I'm not really worried about that, quite honestly. What I'm worried about, because if you just look around, there's so much that we're not doing. You know, I kind of feel like there's three or four arguments that you can make against this fear of AI taking jobs. The first is that as Hal Varian, Google's chief economist, gives a talk he has called Bots versus Tots. And which is just look at demographics. In a lot of advanced countries, he said, if the robots arrive, they will be lucky if they arrive in time. You know, we will need the labor productivity of robots because we don't have enough people coming along to support our aging populations in Western countries. And either that or immigration, you're gonna have to do one of the two. But that's probably even the less important. The real thing is we actually have to pass along the productivity gains. You know, if you look at the Industrial Revolution, we took all that productivity and we gave it to people in the form of reduced working hours and higher wages. And the average person in the 19th century worked 70, 80 hours a week, and then we went down to 35 or 40 in a lot of countries. And then it started creeping back up around this idea that we need to make the economy more efficient machine. And now people are paid less and working, we're going backwards instead of forwards. But it doesn't have to be that way. We just stopped, we stopped optimizing for human well-being and started we optimized for well-being from the point of view of consumer pricing and consumer goods, but not from labor. We didn't give people more time. And so I think that there's a huge opportunity to give people back time. And we have small things like that, like improved parental leave, for example. I like Kai-Fu Lee in his book, AI Superpowers, has this great idea at the end. He says, look, we should be using this productivity explosion of robots to fund what he calls a social investment stipend. You know, and that in some ways, and this is, I guess, another book that I've learned a lot from was Mariana Mazzucato's book, The Value of Everything, which is, you know, this idea that we decide what's valuable in our economy. And there's still a whole lot of things that we just don't include as economically valuable, even though they're so obviously valuable. And COVID is changing some of that. Caring, you know, I mean, looking after people. And so you start thinking about that and you go, oh, how would we, you know, provide a stipend for doing things like, you know, looking after children? As, again, I mentioned we have some of that now. If you work for a big company, you get good childcare, but why not have that for everybody? Looking about, we all have more aging parents. Oh my gosh, we got to fund that somehow. And I think we'll find our way there by giving people more time or giving them money to do things that, you know, we used to just say, well, no, that's on your nickel. And we just have to build the right recirculation mechanisms for that to work. But above all, we need to understand that the economy is supposed to serve people. And instead, we somehow have given primacy to actually the value of the machine under this idea that, of course, you know, this is that Milton Friedman doctrine. Well, you give the money to the shareholders and they will decide what to do with it. But given that the shareholders are a very small subset of society, that doesn't really work. We have to have widespread prosperity and we have to have the benefits of all this productivity go to everyone. So anyway, but the other thing is on this sort of value boundary, you think about all the things that people do for love, not money. You go, why do we think that people, you know, if you get the economic machine circulating well enough, you know, people will enjoy being with their friends. You know, you think about, you know, the work that Dan Buettner did on what so-called blue zones, places where people live a long time. They socialize a lot. You know, the places where, you know, they also have a lot of physical activity. You know, you can easily imagine an economy where people are not working, but they're working at their social media feed. You know, they're creating content for other people to enjoy. Oh, wait, you know, why is it that, you know, somebody who writes, you know, poetry, you know, and says, I'm a poet and I got a job at a university, you know, but I'm really a poet, is considered to be working? Or an actor who gets a job every other year, you know, that's their real work. But somebody who makes YouTube videos isn't. But that's changing, of course, because now all of a sudden there's all these people who are actually, we figured out how to convert that creative economy into the money economy.
Into money again.
And yeah. So much.
And
that's right. And so
everything is an auction. That is, in a way,
that's
also
right.
Very stressful.
But I mean, there is a way that we are building a new kind of creative economy where there is convertibility. And of course, the software world is part of that too. You know, we are creating for each other. And that's one of the things that's beautiful about software. And the fact that Silicon Valley has made it so much about money. I guess this goes back to what is a little bit sad. I mean, most of the real flourishing of software innovation that I've been around has been in markets where people didn't think there was a lot of money to be made. In the early PC, yeah, there were some people like Bill Gates who were like, oh yeah, this is going to be a boom, but so many of the people were just like, oh, this is so cool. I have my own computer. I don't have to go to the big, university center or whatever. I can actually have one of these things myself. And it was this incredibly absorbing thing. And you're creating and you're sharing. And then the internet, you know, it kind of the piece, it, you know, Microsoft sucked that opportunity out of the personal computer market and it rebuilt itself on the internet. And I think we see this periodic rebirth of innovation for the hell of it. You know, again, even think about something like crypto. You know, the early crypto enthusiasts didn't think, you know, they had no sense that it was going to be this incredibly valuable thing. It was really all about freedom originally. All the original, you know, cypherpunks and crypto people were like, we're going to build a currency that's independent of the man, you know? And then later on, it went more rapidly than some of the other things into, wow, being very centralized. Again, going back to my principle that I use all the time, Clay Christensen called it the law of conservation of attractive profits, which is when one thing becomes cheap or free or commoditized, something else becomes valuable. So that was I had given my talk about how it was hardware and it went to software and then is going to data. And he gave this talk at the same conference. It was, I think it was the first open source business conference. And we went, oh, we're talking about the same thing, about this law of conservation of attractive profits. And, you know, crypto tended out to be centralized by way of power in some ways. Also, there was some innate centralization in that it's something of a pyramid scheme. You know, the people who issue the currency that becomes popular end up holding it all. So it was actually far less liberating than some of the early technologies like the internet.
But there's other... Yeah, there's a slight chance. There's also, I think, the term Web 3.0 or Web 3 somewhere in the Ethereum ecosystem, which you might know. I mean, as the inventor of Web 2.0, there is a chance to for the web to actually become more decentralized again through stuff like Ethereum, right?
I think that's right, and Ethereum is intellectually very, very interesting, and Vitalik is brilliant. And so, yes, I think that, and the whole that I'm not as deep into that world as I might have been earlier in my career. You know, just at this point, I'm kind of like I'm doing more economics than I am doing technology, because I'm trying to change this. And public policy, you know, I'm really trying to change the way people think about, you know, I'm trying to help people to learn from the technology about public policy and the economy. But I think it's super interesting. The thing that I guess I would say that's going to be most liberating, quite honestly, is, and most urgent, is that we actually have to solve some new problems. I think that the biggest driver of both innovation and wealth creation over the next a couple of decades are going to be in public health and in climate change. And, you know, and in fact, that's really the last reason that I gave in my book why we didn't need to be afraid that we'd run out of jobs, because, oh my gosh, you know, there's some real challenges ahead of us and we will need all the help we can get. You know, and that's the kind of the wonderful thing. I mean, you know, if you look at the production of the COVID vaccines, you know, it's like amazing technology driven innovation. And we're sat now suddenly going, oh, we may be able to do mRNA vaccines for other diseases. You know, we may have a transformational opportunity there. You look at what's happening with the inflection point we've reached around electric vehicles, you know, the cost of renewables. You know, we're really at a point where we're actually building a new economy that's going to be around the next generation of problems. And I kind of see in a lot of ways the computer tech for computer tech's sake is actually being a little out of step with the next wave of opportunities. It's really going to be these new areas where we can apply this. And I guess you could say that blockchain is that, you know, applied to, you know, in some ways to certain aspects of the economy. So yes, maybe it's an applied technology too.
So apart from that, do you see like huge trends that are more connected to technology, like up the hill a bit, or?
Well, the things I talked about are huge trends connected to technology. I mean, the fact that, you know, we're, you know, biotech, I think, something like, I think it was a recent study I saw, that there were 20,000 papers on, you know, machine learning in biology, you know, published. That's huge. You know, the technology is converging with all these other fields. You know, you read, whether they're hyped or not, you're hearing, you know, about, you know, they're making real progress on fusion, for Christ's sake, you know. For the first time, it seemed like it was always unattainable. I think that there is a, you know, we're starting to do lab grown meat. You look at things like vertical farming, you know, which it's so astonishing. When you talk to some of the people who are doing vertical farming, they are using the exact same types of technology that, say, Facebook does with hyper-targeted advertising, except they're doing hyper-targeted, you know, light and water and nutrients, you know, to lettuce or strawberries. You know, it's amazing. They're just basically they're monitoring, you know, and going, oh, okay, we adjust this, we adjust that to optimize, you know, the production of particular flavors. And it's all incredibly driven by, you know, computer technology in this realm. You know, farming is going to be utterly transformed over the next few decades.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
In food production.
I can imagine that, yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
vegetarian
food or artificial meat and stuff like that, where like the huge revolutions are just around the corner, right?
Yeah, that's right. I think that's absolutely right.
And you mentioned mRNA and the things that happen in biotech. Any other chances? So you are like a quite positive guy who sees chances, as far as I see you. Any other chances you see across the road when COVID is gone? Any how do you think our work will evolve? Will this like potentially shape us a bit more towards working less?
It's really interesting. First of all, I don't ever try to predict the future, despite the fact that people have said that about me. I feel like what I try to do is to identify factors in the present that are going to influence the future. You know, it's like, you know, it's like saying, here's this thing that's happening. It's important. And I think about the future as the sum of a set of vectors. And you can kind of look at those vectors, but they're always unpredictable vectors. You know what I mean? You know, we kind of knew that pandemics were a possibility. We didn't know this particular one, that it was going to come now. So I guess I would just say that COVID, you know, I do think, I think it's radically reshaping people's understanding and expectations about office work. I don't think we're going to be going back to the kind of office culture that we had pre-COVID. And I think that's going to have a big shape on economic geography. It's going to have a big shaping force on the cost of real estate. And we may yet see a real, serious economic collapse related to, all the overbuilt office real estate. I don't know that for sure, but at least, the other thing, I wrote this whole piece is a series I wrote starting with an essay called Welcome to the 21st Century. And I really talked about how I use scenario planning in my thinking, which is you think about a range of possibilities, and then you look at the vectors and they might take you in this area or in that direction. And you're really trying to think probabilistically about a lot of things that could happen. And then you're just kind of watching for things that change your priors about what's actually going to happen. And so I look at this and I go, yeah, we could have people go, oh yeah, we're going to start downsizing offices. And there'll be a set of people who had really big offices and they move into smaller offices. And so there's kind of a mid-market size that's probably going to be reasonably well served. But the people who have giant physical plants are probably not going to need them, and we'll see what happens there. But it could bring down prices, and depending on how leveraged, the real estate investors are, it's not going to be terrible for Google. They own all these properties, and but if you're a real estate investor who's bet on particular, level of rents in downtown San Francisco, you may well be going bankrupt in the future.
So,
if there's enough
bad time for WeWork,
if there's enough of those people. Well, maybe, maybe not. I mean, it's hard to say. It could also be that this is, WeWork will be one of those things that has arrived just in time. Although I have to say, my problem with companies like WeWork and some extent Uber and Lyft is that we replaced true market competition with competition between venture capitalists. You know, effectively, the market never decided what was the right business model. You know, the venture capitalists did. You know, Sunil Paul was the guy who invented the model. He raised $35 million. That was actually the same amount that Google raised. You know, and that was all it took for Google. And, you know, but if somebody had come along and said, well, you know, we're just going to pump so much money into some other technology that will, you know, again, it might not have worked with Google because they really did have a unique, better mousetrap. But the companies that won, you know, like, I guess I think if we hadn't had so much cheap capital coming in, you know, where Uber literally raised billions, what we would have had is a lot more local experiments in this new model. Just like we had lots of local websites. I mean, Google didn't come out in 1991. It came out in 1998. The web had, you know, went public in, what, 89? You know, we saw Yahoo in 94. RGNN was the first in 93. You know, Amazon started in 95. You know, you really had this, you know, almost a 10-year period before Google, you know, came along, it was almost 15 years into the web before it went public. And, you know, money started flowing into the gig economy at massive scale, maybe 3 years in. And so nobody got to experiment. What would have been really the right way to grow that thing, to price it, to compensate drivers? You know, instead we had a model, and this is what I wrote about in this piece I wrote. It was a critique of Reid Hoffman's blitzscaling book called What's Wrong with Silicon Valley's Favorite Growth Model. And it's this idea that you want to get to monopoly as quickly as possible. You raise a lot of money. And I think it's fundamentally anti-competitive because the VCs, you know, start to gather and decide this is going to be the winner. And the one with the most capital, if it's a market where it's very expensive to acquire customers, the one with the most money wins, and not necessarily the best technology or the best business model.
Which is not the best thing, right? That is something you can absorb.
And so how
do you change that?
Well, I think part of the way you change is by getting people to recognize it, mm-hmm. you know, and you get antitrust regulators to recognize it that, you know, like the business model of Silicon Valley today is monopoly. And if you're anti-monopoly, you need to go back to the root causes, not to the, you know, catch them when it's already too late. But I think, you know, so there's sort of some competition policy things. But the biggest one, I think, is realizing that we have optimized our economy for capital. And, you know, when there's just a lot of confusion, and a lot of what I'm trying to get people to recognize is that the financial markets are not the same thing as the operating economy of ordinary people and small businesses. And if you optimize for gigantism, you know, the whole idea about economic efficiency says McDonald's is better than that great little bistro down on the corner, right? Because they're more profitable for, you know, it's a big, you know, they make lots of money. You know, Walmart is better than the local store. Amazon is better than the local store. And you know, it's sort of interesting. So in the context of Biden's proposal to treat capital gains taxes, I go, yeah, why are we paying, why in the U.S. do we pay lower taxes on money that you don't actually, you know, it's just money on top of money, because most of the people are making it are, you know, you put in an investment, you get back, you know, 10x your money, and you pay way less than somebody who has to actually work for their money. You know, and I kind of feel like, yeah, it's painful if you're rich and you kind of go, I was thinking I was going to get so much, but is that really not a bad thing? If we actually slow down the movement of capital, if we slow down the ability of venture capitalists to throw billions at, you know, at a WeWork, which turned out not to be a terribly good investment, but also turned out to basically you know, kill all the other people who were doing innovative things because they had so much capital, they could underprice all the little local startups that were going, oh, we could apply this sort of technology model of on-demand to office space. You know, I mean, they were basically, you know, WeWork killed everybody else, just like Uber killed everybody else because we made capital so cheap that there was too much of it. You know, it's same thing in farming. You know, it's like it's more efficient to have these massive farms. And I think part of the opportunity of what we have today is we can get efficiency without scale.
Absolutely.
And I think that's going to be a really interesting shift to go, oh, you know, we learned the wrong lesson with efficiency and scale are somehow locked together when in fact, we've now built all these efficiency machines that allow things to be small and efficient.
Yeah, the interesting thing is that the people that now like organic food, for example, are the ones earning the most money. But still, yeah. I mean, it's an interesting observation of how such trends can evolve and lead to potentially a better world in the future, right?
That's right. That's right. I actually talk about organic food again in my book, WTF, as an example of how the economy could change, which is that when things become a commodity, you make them valuable by mixing in ideas. You know, it's like the creative economy. You know, it's not just, hey, this isn't just organic, it's gluten free. Oh, wait, this isn't just, organic, it's locally sourced. This isn't just organic, it's we add ideas to things, and that's part of the creative economy too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting thoughts. Yeah. Maybe coming a bit closer to the end of my questions, I have one for you, which is hard to answer, but I have a lot of CTOs listening, and we didn't do a very technical podcast, but if you could recommend three things to every CTO out there, what would it be? Can be anything.
Let me think about this. I mean, I think one of the first things I would recommend is that I do think that machine learning is going to be transformative for every enterprise. And even though there's people are kind of going, is it really as big a deal? As we think, my own experience just with our machine learning powered search on the O'Reilly platform, we've rolled out this answers feature, but we're kind of, there's more to come. It's so astonishingly better than the previous generation. And I actually think that there's something really interesting. The tool we're using is from a company called Miso. It was trained using BERT, Google's large language model. And I sometimes think that Google's release of BERT may be analogous to IBM's release of the PC specs and may mark the end of certain aspects of Google's dominance, because these large language models really encapsulate a lot of what, you know, people like Google did, which was to sort of capture all the collective knowledge and they make it accessible. And again, obviously, we had to train it on our own corpus, but there was this base there, which made it amazingly simple to, to have, Google quality search on our corpus. And so I sort of see, for example, that decentralized search and sort of, I think it's going to be very interesting for Amazon too, because e-commerce search is going to get a lot better, much more plain language because of some of these machine learning capabilities. So everybody who's thinking about how do I make my e-commerce better? You are going to be able to just describe what you want in plain language, just like you can with our answers. You want to know the answer to some question, and bang, oh my God. I can just talk to this thing, there's going to be a lot of applications of ML, but that's just one that I personally have been you know, feel is really transformative for our business. Yeah, I think we're still early in cloud. You know, everybody's kind of getting it. But one of the big mistakes we often, I've probably made more, it's probably the mistake I've made more often in my career than anything else. I'm kind of living in the future and I think, oh, it's arrived. And you realize, oh no, there's so much more to arrive. You know, I mean, the, like I see it with the early, you know, what people used to call the alpha geeks. And I go, oh, it's hit the mainstream. You know, it's over, move on. And of course, when I think it's hit the mainstream, it's really just the early adopters, you know? And so I guess what I would say is, I think cloud is still really in its early adopter phase.
And it's more than people SaaS realize. SaaS potentially as well, right? I mean, SaaS pretty much
sticks
to the cloud. And I think there are big chances for, let's say, people that just want to bootstrap a company to just build a subscription model, build a nice SaaS company and get it running, right?
Well, and I think there's this whole API economy now where there's so many things that you can do simply by pointing to some API endpoints. You know, you think about, companies like Stripe with payments where they've, or Twilio, you know, they're really just, it's kind of was part of that original vision I had of Web 2.0, which was this sort of, the programmable web is really becoming true in a way that it, in the early days, it was a few areas, but really it's becoming a real programmable fabric. I remember in the first Web 2.0 conference in 2004, Bram Cohen of BitTorrent made fun. He gave a talk making fun of my idea that the internet was becoming the operating system. And of course, now it's pretty damn obvious that
it is.
I was right. But it was a little early in 2004 to be calling that one. but the third, I think you talk about. I think there's a really interesting thing that I think a lot about because we're in the online learning business, which is knowledge augmentation. And, we forget how much the world is changing under us. You know, we basically have mental prosthetics in a way that we didn't have before. You know, and I use Google Maps as a great example. You know, we all can get anywhere, anytime. We outsource that to a machine. And you can see how, that then enabled things like on-demand grocery delivery, on-demand car hire, all those capabilities that were there in GPS, once all the pieces came together and we all had smartphones with GPS in them, we all, people started to build that next layer up. And, the integration of humans and machines in new ways, so that workers are augmented, like an Uber driver is an augmented worker, they are an extension of the machine, an Amazon delivery driver, extension of the machine, Amazon warehouse worker, extension of the machine. So I would say to CTOs, think about what technologies are augmentations for your workers. And again, that's what drives our thinking at the O'Reilly platform. How do we make it a more useful set of augmentations for software developers? I think that we're going to wake up one day and realize that we've built entirely different workflows around this idea of human and machine partnerships, and companies that get better at that are going to have a real competitive advantage. I mean, if you look at people, companies like Google, like Amazon, that's the heart of what they're good at. They've done these really creative, powerful integrations of human and machine around tasks that couldn't be done by either alone.
Thanks a lot. Very good answer. I like it a lot. Very, very thoughtful and deep. I still have a little surprise for you, Tim. So I actually found a book in my bookshelf published by you called Python for Time Travelers. And I saw a very simple code snippet which used like a secret function in pandas, in the pandas library, to actually not only handle time series data and process it, but also travel back in time. And we now have the chance to travel back in the early 90s. I think you published a book called The Internet User's Guide back then, which you shot after sold to AOL, I think. And we now have the chance to observe you for a while. And then you get the chance to whisper something into your ears back then. What would it be?
Keep going. You know, I mean, there's so many things that, you know, you might do differently in retrospect, but I don't think I would really change all that much. I mean, I definitely think that I missed some opportunities because I was sort of stubborn and I wanted to have my own company and I did not want to take money. I'd been a consultant and I didn't want to go that way. But I wanted to just keep doing what I loved, which was to help people to learn. And I feel really, really good about that. And I guess I think of that great Stuart Brand quote that Steve Jobs loved, stay hungry, stay foolish. I think about it. I guess my version of that would be, we live in a world where there's so much opportunity to invent, and the creativity of people is the joy. That's what we're good at. We're good at inventing for each other. And whether it's in art or music or coding, you know, just make shit that's amazing. And, I use this line all the time, create more value than you capture. Don't, you know, Silicon Valley's gone wrong around it, thinking it's all about money. It's all about creating stuff you love that other people will love.
Thanks a lot. Great, great closing sentences and good reflection. So, I really enjoyed talking to you, Tim. And it was an honor meeting you personally here, even if it was virtual. Hope we get the chance to change that in the future. I wish you a lot of luck in your personal life and your business and the stuff you love doing. And yeah, thanks a lot for being here.
All right, you're very welcome. Thank you. Bye bye.
Thanks again to our sponsors, Fastly and the About You Cloud. If you want to know more about Fastly services, simply visit fastly.com/alphalist. If you want to get in touch with About You and hear more about the About You Cloud, simply write to hello@aboutyou.com. Thanks a lot.